Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Richard Clark knows terrorism better than almost anyone. He spent 30 years working in national security and warned of the grave threat posed by al-Qaeda before 9/11 when he worked in the White House. Now, with the latest attack in the UK, nuclear threats from North Korea, and Russian hacking, he warns history could repeat itself. This hour on Point, Richard Clark on threats headed our way and what we can do to stop them. You can join us on air or online. What questions do you have for Richard Clark about Russia, North Korea, the Manchester attack, or future cyber attacks? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And joining us now is Richard Clark, former National Counterterrorism Coordinator on the White House National Security Council during both Bill Clinton's and George W. Bush's administrations. He was in the role before, during, and after the September 11th attacks. He's also the author of 7 previous books. His latest, with R.P. Eddy, is Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Stop Catastrophes. You can read an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. Richard, thanks so much for joining us today.
No, it's great to be with you.
So there is so much to cover in this book, and it is fascinating. I will get to it, but I wanted to start with some of the breaking stories that are in the news right now and the horror that we saw unfold in Manchester. Do you think we're better prepared here in the U.S. than they are in Europe?
Well, I think the British police and intelligence services are among the best in the world. So I wouldn't say that our police and intelligence services are better. They're as good. I think the big difference between the United States and the United Kingdom is that in the United Kingdom, much of their Muslim population, their Islamic population, is isolated physically and otherwise from the rest of society. And in the United States, that's much less so, not entirely integrated, but much less of a problem here in the United States. I think the vast majority of American Muslims feel that they are Americans, feel that this is their country. That's not true in Europe.
So the American embrace makes a difference.
It does, and that's why having discussions, as we did in the campaign of last year, that make Muslims the other, that try to separate Americans who practice that religion from the rest of us, is very counterproductive.
You've written a book about catastrophes we could avoid. Staying on the news again today, do you think Western states are doing enough to avoid these kinds of attacks, or are we ignoring warnings?
I think we are ignoring the advice of a lot of experts, which is go after them on an ideological level. Go after them on the messaging, because you can stop individual terrorists and fight individual terrorists forever, and it will just continue to happen until you go after the root causes. There are many root causes, but one of them is that they have an ideology that is appealing to disaffected Muslim youth. And I was disappointed, frankly, in the president's Riyadh speech, where his formula to deal with terrorism was simply drive them out. Well, yeah, we want to drive them out. People have actually thought of that before. It's not an original idea. His audience of 50 world leaders from Muslim countries have been trying to drive them out for 2 decades now. We need more than just rhetoric like that. We need programs to counter their messaging and to go after the fundamental root causes, which sometimes in some countries are socio and economic.
I'll circle back to this topic when we speak about ISIS in a bit, but I want to turn our attention now to Washington, D.C., where the House Intelligence Committee is holding a hearing on Russian interference in our election. The former director of the CIA, John Brennan, was testifying, and he said that it's clear Russia did interfere.
It should be clear to everyone that Russia brazenly interfered in our 2016 presidential election process, and that they undertook these activities despite our strong protests and explicit warning that they not do so.
Were there warnings?
There were. I have this concept of a Cassandra, which is someone who's an expert who gives a warning, and that warning is not heeded. In this case, a British spy named Christopher Steele had done extensive work trying to figure out what the Russians were up to with our election and with the Trump campaign and the Trump organization. He had a lot of sources, sensitive sources, human sources, in Moscow, where he used to work as an intelligence officer. And he wrote up what was known as the Steele dossier. And people tried to get mainstream media in the United States to read it during the campaign and to talk about it during the campaign. And almost no one did. I think if we had paid attention to that Cassandra, to Christopher Steele, the outcome might have been different.
I recall in October, before the election, the Obama administration also put out a warning that Russia was interfering and hacking in some way. And that, too, didn't get much press. Should they have done something more to call attention to it?
I think they should have, and they should have done it much earlier in the process because they knew earlier in the process. And off the record, some of the Obama administration people have said that to me, that they deeply regret that they didn't reveal more and reveal it more early in the campaign.
This is a topic of some fascination for me as a former TV political reporter, and I am sort of riveted by this question that why didn't it get more press? Do you have a theory about why certain warnings are ignored, both in the media and by government experts?
Well, we have a very elaborate theory in the book Warnings. We have 22 factors that sometimes affect these decisions.
Give us your top three.
I'll mention a few. The one is outlandishness. If what you're predicting, the disaster you're predicting, is outlandish, if it's the stuff of Hollywood fiction, and for example, one of our Cassandras is very concerned with asteroids hitting the Earth. Now, he's not a nutty guy. He's a leading astrophysicist, and he has very good data. But we've seen movies about asteroids hitting the Earth, and therefore we kind of think of that threat as science fiction. It's too outlandish. That's one. Another one is, it's never happened before. If what you're predicting, if the catastrophe you're predicting has never happened before, then the listener, the decision maker, somehow implicitly thinks it will never happen. Now, that's not logical, but in case after case, we see decision makers using that as the excuse for not acting.
Could this be still the case? I ask this because former FBI Director Brennan, in his testimony, just said that right now, at this moment, Russia and even Putin are watching Washington very closely to exploit the situation and further partisan animosity. He said right now they're trying to actively exploit it to their benefit and our detriment. Are we ignoring warnings in this moment?
Well, I think some people in Congress and some people in the administration are. It's very clear what the Russians are about. It's not just in the United States. They're doing this in democracies all over Europe as well. They're trying to get us preoccupied with internal divisions rather than having a strong country growing our economy. They'd love to see us just dissolve into political civil war.
Can you explain for the audience, because people ask this of me all the time, what does it mean that they hacked our election? We know about fake news stories getting circulated, but what else did they do?
Well, so they did a number of things. We know they hacked into the Hillary campaign. We know they hacked into John Podesta, at least, in the Hillary campaign. They hacked into the Democratic National Convention committee, rather, and then they published that material through a cutout with WikiLeaks. But then what I think is really the most effective thing they did was they micro-targeted individual voters. They got profiles of individual voters from social media and in other ways, and then they sent specific Facebook and Twitter messages to those people designed for that voter. And they did it by interest group. They did it by geography. Some of it was fake news. Some of it was distorted news. And over time, the drip, drip, drip of those messages had an effect. And when you saw those messages in your Facebook stream or your Twitter stream, it didn't look like they were fake because there were 30 or 40 people who had already commented favorably on them. Of course, those 30 or 40 people didn't exist.
So that was during the election. Now, fast forward to current day. If it's proven that members of the White House team do have an unusually close relationship with Russia, or people close to the president do, what dangers does that pose?
Well, we have to understand what Russia is about. They're an adversary. They are not a friend. They're not even a frenemy. They're an adversary, and they are trying to divide us from our allies. They're trying to break up NATO. They're trying to break up the European Union. They're trying to keep the United States preoccupied here at home with political division. And then if we have an administration that pretends none of that is true, we're actually aiding and abetting them in doing all of that.
Now, I believe this is correct. You've said you supported appointing a special prosecutor or special counsel, yes?
Absolutely. I think the American people deserve to know from someone like Bob Mueller, who I know and have known for a very long time and completely respect, somebody they can trust like Bob Mueller. And if he comes back and says there was no collusion between anybody in the Trump campaign and Russia, I will believe that from him.
But how deep do you fear this goes? Or do you think it
goes? Well, I don't know. I don't know. There's a great deal of smoke. It seems like almost every time you pick up an issue, there's a Russian underneath it. and that can't, you know, that can't all be true. But there are deep ties. The president says he doesn't have any ties with Russia, but he does. And they go back a long way. And a lot of his investors were Russian oligarchs and Russian gangsters.
And quickly before we go to break, do you want to see more, a special committee in Congress as well?
I think I'm happy having a special counsel, especially Bob Mueller.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about security threats headed our way and what we can do to stop them. You can join the conversation. Do you feel safe? Are you worried about attacks from foreign countries or from inside our own nation? Are you worried about other threats? We're talking now with Richard Clark, who led counterterrorism efforts for Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. His new book is Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Stop Catastrophes. So, Dick, part of your cause is to get the world to pay attention to early warning signs, people who are sending up flares. And in your own experience, we know that you predicted 9/11 and more specifically the threat posed by al-Qaeda and weren't heeded. I'm curious, what is your view now of ISIS? And is this an existential threat to the U.S.?
Well, I don't think it's an existential threat, but it's a significant threat. And it's one of the things that we look at in the book Warnings. We found a Cassandra. We found an expert, Robert Ford, our former ambassador to Syria, who absolutely predicted the rise of ISIS 2 years before it happened. And every time we look at a major disaster or catastrophe that has happened, we find somebody like that, an expert who was an outlier. Other experts were not agreeing with them, but they predicted accurately based on data what was going to happen. And they were ignored. So what the book is about, it's about these people. It's profiles of these people, case studies of these people. But what the book is about is how do we find these people before the catastrophe so that we might be able to prevent the catastrophe?
Is there something to be learned from the Ford example? Why was he ignored?
Well, he was ignored, again, because what he was predicting seemed outlandish, that there would be a new terrorist group, that it would take over cities and whole territory and run a state. Al-Qaeda never did that. Mm. In fact, it had never happened before. So we go through about 22 factors in the book of why people pay no attention to these experts. And unfortunately, we think it's happening again. We've got seven cases of where it happened in the past, seven people in different fields, in finance, in intelligence, in engineering. And we have seven other cases where we think it's happening again, where people are making predictions about artificial intelligence, gene editing, asteroids, the Internet of Things. And these people, experts, are being ignored. My favorite is the one who is predicting sea level rise much faster and much higher than the other experts. His name is Jim Hansen, and he's at Columbia University. And he's been proven to be right in the past about things like this. And yet today, his warnings are largely being ignored.
Let's pause for a moment and listen to a fellow who actually changed his life because he was concerned about exactly what you're talking about. CNN interviewed a man named Dan Kipnis, a retired fisherman who decided to leave his longtime home in Miami Beach because he was afraid of what climate change will do to create extreme flooding in his region.
I'm very sad to leave here. I'm third generation Miami Beach. Over my lifetime, I've seen it go from no floods ever to sunny day flooding on a regular basis. The ends of my street already flood. Now they're coming in and replacing my street and raising it up a foot and putting in new stormwater systems. But that still won't stop the bay and ocean from coming up. It won't stop it.
Now, a lot of people would listen to that and think that's a little extreme, moving because of the fears of climate change. But you cite a statistic by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change predicting that by the year 2100, sea levels will rise between 0.28 and 0.98 meters. That means residents of coastal cities would be flooded if they stay.
And what Dr. James Hansen is saying is that that's a massive underestimation. He says it'll be much higher and it will be much faster. So what that means, Jessica, is that there are people alive today, our children and grandchildren, who will not be able to use many of our East Coast cities because they won't be there.
To me, that doesn't just sound like an outlier, but it does sound like the stuff of science fiction movies. Is there anything we can do to reverse it?
Well, what Dr. Hansen says in the interviews we conducted with him for the book is that if we act rapidly to be far more ambitious than the UN Paris Accord on climate change was with regard to carbon output into the atmosphere, if we act rapidly and control it and get the number down much lower, he thinks the worst case scenario won't develop. But it's possible that we already have the forces at work that will create that worst-case scenario faster and higher than the UN believes.
On the line is Michael. He's calling in from Yankton, South Dakota. Hi, Michael. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica and Mr. Clark. It's great to be on the radio with you as well. I guess my comment is, how do we really know which catastrophes to prioritize or which ones are real when it seems like there's so many Cassandras, but there's also a lot of Alex Joneses out there. And some of the things are really unbelievable. And I think maybe one of the problems is not the facts themselves, but people are so fearful right now of so many things that they can't really rationally evaluate these different things.
How do we parse? Go ahead.
I think that's exactly the question. And so what we propose in the book is that we have an organization, small organization in the government, or it could be outside the government, that looks for these people and puts experts together, goes through their data, and really looks with an impartial eye at these warnings and makes a decision as to which ones are Chicken Little and which ones are Cassandra. Remember, Cassandra, the myth, she was right when she predicted disaster. So we're looking for the people who are right. And we think you can identify them using some of the criteria we developed in our case studies.
Do we have any history of listening to the outliers and elevating people who are right, even when they sound different?
Well, we have on occasion made decisions to do things that turned out to be wrong because of an expert. When President Ford was in office, he was told by experts there was going to be a massive flu that would kill tens of thousands of people. And therefore, there needed to be a vaccine very quickly that had not been fully tested. And he authorized all of that, and the flu never came. So we went back and we looked at that case and we asked ourselves, why? What was wrong there? And it turns out that some of the data was wrong. That could have been discovered. And what the experts, what the real experts were saying was exaggerated by bureaucrats and politicians.
Turning to another potential catastrophe, you write about potential nuclear war between India and Pakistan. There's another nuclear threat we're all facing right now, or the potential, in North Korea. Let's listen for a moment to UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, who talked to the Today Show about the U.S.'s relationship with North Korea. The correspondent started by asking when the U.S. would move past its current threat of sanctions.
At what point do we try something else? At what point do we concede that's not working?
We're doing that now in terms of getting another resolution together, looking at sanctions and how we're going to continue to force it, because this is the same movie that keeps playing.
All options are on the table.
All options are on the table.
What does that mean? What does that include?
That means that we have made it very clear we don't want to start a fight, so don't give us a reason to have one.
So is this a case of not taking the threat seriously enough, or not developing adequate responses, or are we sort of between a rock and a hard place in North Korea and there are no good moves?
Well, what bothers me is the Cassandra we found about this was Alan Robach. He's a professor at Rutgers. And his climate models suggest that even a relatively limited nuclear war would kick up enough material into the atmosphere that we would have what he calls a mini nuclear winter, that for 2 or 3 years, the sun would be occluded and there would be major crop failure. So you can't think of any nuclear war at any scale as being just a little one. There is no such thing as a little nuclear war. Now, we believe North Korea already has 20 nuclear weapons. If the United States moved beyond sanctions to a military solution, General Mattis, Secretary of Defense Mattis, said the other day, that would be a tragedy of unbelievable consequences. If you have 20 nuclear weapons going off on their side, and if the United States resorted to nuclear weapons, the Korean Peninsula would be destroyed, thousands of people would be killed, but there might also, according to Alan Robach, there might also be a global climate problem for 2 or 3 years caused by that kind of war on one peninsula.
We could, though, pressure China to do more to back them down from their nuclear program. And we would have to make certain extreme concessions in order to allow that. Do you think this should be more of a priority than we're making it?
I think it's a very big priority for this administration. They are pressuring China, but there's only so much China can do. And at the end of the day, North Korea may just believe it needs a nuclear weapon. They're paranoid as a nation, but try to look at it from their perspective. They may think that if they have nuclear weapons, as they now do, that the United States will never attack them. And if that's their philosophy, it's going to be very hard to persuade them otherwise.
Turning to another issue you highlight in the book, cyber dangers. Now, just in the last week, 2 weeks, a major cyber attack hit around the world, and you said this came despite repeated warnings.
It did. People have been warning for years that if you don't fix your systems, if you don't patch your systems when you're warned to do so by the manufacturer, in this case, Microsoft. Microsoft issued a critical patch 2 months before this attack occurred. And there were apparently millions of people, organizations, hospitals, even FedEx apparently, that didn't patch their systems. Now, at some point, that becomes kind of cyber mismanagement. When you're told that there's a security problem and you ignore it.
After it was called the WannaCry ransomware attack, and after it hit hundreds of countries, ABC News's chief investigative correspondent Brian Ross sort of laid out the scope of the attack. Listen to this.
It was pretty bad. It spread rapidly, faster than anything they've seen before. 150 countries, 200,000 computers targeted. In this country, the biggest hit was at FedEx, which has huge numbers of computers. All their trucks have computers. Mm-hmm. And then overseas, in Britain, the hospitals, the railroads in Germany and Russia.
Now, a surprising coda to this is that the NSA, the U.S.'s NSA, apparently knew and did nothing.
Well, exactly. And President Obama put together a group of five people to look at NSA after the Snowden leaks in 2012 and 2013. I was one of those five people. And the report that we gave him and the public said that this sort of thing could happen, that if we didn't improve security at NSA, that NSA's own tools could have been stolen. And if when NSA discovers a vulnerability in something like Microsoft Windows, they don't tell Microsoft about it, then attacks are going to occur on U.S. infrastructure using that vulnerability. So that report from 2013 predicted to a very large extent what just happened.
Alexandra is calling in from Miami, Florida, with a comment on this. Alexandra, what's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I just think there seems to be a pattern, and I don't know if this is mismanagement of information between the agencies that you did or compass of security that nothing can harm us, but since 9/11, they said if the CIA and the FBI had communicated, we would have connected the dots and we would have prevented it. And things keep happening, and I don't think we have we are very naive or we think nothing can harm us, but what is happening? Why can't they work it out? I think they have the technological capabilities.
Thank you, Alexandra. So, Dick, let me put it to you this way. There was a lot of talk after 9/11 that there was what we called stovepiping, intelligence agencies not communicating, not sharing information. Has that substantially changed?
Yeah, I think it has. But to be frank, there was, while the 9/11 Commission said there was a lot of stovepiping, there actually wasn't. I ran a process every week to make sure that the FBI and the CIA were exchanging information about the al-Qaeda threat. And there was only one piece of intelligence in retrospect that the CIA had that it didn't share with me, didn't share with the FBI. And that one piece of intelligence could have been crucial because that piece of intelligence was two al-Qaeda terrorists had entered the United States a year and a half before 9/11.
Hmm. Is there a sense now that I'm sort of curious, we're talking about people ignoring outliers, ignoring anybody who isn't saying what one would expect to hear. In Washington, D.C., I lived there for a long time. It's an environment where there is a lot of pressure to sort of be with the pack, if it's pack reporting, pack thinking inside administrations. Is some of this changing communications or how we engage our experts? It seems to me this is a little bit about approaching outsiders differently.
It's about believing that the outlandish can happen. It's about looking for experts who are outside of the pack, the outliers. Because, you know, if you just look at history, it is constantly the case that things change, new things happen, things that we couldn't believe would happen. That's the pattern of history. And yet, we don't learn from that, and we don't look for the indicators that things are about to change, that something's about to happen that never happened before. If we did that systematically, this is what we argue in the book Warnings, if we did that systematically, we might find some of these problems before they get worse.
Do you think there is something that could have been done differently to avoid WannaCry? Clearly,
oh, absolutely.
NSA could have alerted the world.
NSA, when it discovered the vulnerability in the Microsoft product probably 2 years ago, could have picked up the phone and called Microsoft. And then this would never have occurred.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about experts warning against future catastrophes and why too often we ignore them. You can join the conversation. What future disaster are you most worried about? Climate change, nuclear war, cyber attacks? My guest today is Richard Clark, former counterterrorism coordinator under Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. His new book is Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Stop Catastrophes. Dick, would you tell us a little about other examples of Cassandras in the past? Who else has spoken up we've ignored?
Well, there was a scientist, an engineer in Japan, who said you can't build these nuclear power plants in Fukushima because there will someday be an earthquake that will cause a tidal wave that will cause these plants to be flooded, and then they will have nuclear meltdowns. He laid it all out, and they ignored him, and that's exactly what happened. So we find this over and over again, even in the case of Katrina. You can't predict a hurricane will hit a specific city at a specific time. But there was an engineer, a civil engineer, who said the dikes that the Army Corps of Engineers built around the city were inadequate for a Category 5 or a Category 4 hurricane. And he said it's only a matter of time. And when that happens, they will overtop, the city will be flooded. He was fired for saying that. And of course, he turned out to be right.
One of our listeners writes in on our website, Mari McAvina. She writes, Americans in particular don't like to listen to timely warnings. They call the informed messengers names like negative Nellies and fearmongers. You kind of raised a point in softer terms that we don't like to listen to people who are too outside the norm. Do you see an environment in this White House where people who are outside the decision-making chain raising important issues could be heard?
Well, this White House has an odd relationship with facts. it doesn't like facts with which it disagrees, for example, on climate change. But it does think there are problems with millions of people going over the border into the United States or millions of illegal aliens voting. And the facts are there are no illegal aliens voting in significant numbers. There are no millions of aliens coming across the Mexican border. They have these preconceived notions. For example, they say that terrorists from seven countries come to the United States and commit terrorist acts, and therefore they want to ban people from those seven countries. No one from those seven countries has ever come to the United States and carried out a terrorist attack. So fact-based analysis, expert-driven, data-driven analysis is not something that this White House appears to like.
David is calling in from Perkins, Oklahoma, with a comment. Hi, David. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica. Well, I'm hearing all these different examples that Mr. Clark is giving that really points to a complacency and a lack of culture, maybe to take the initiative to research and to understand what a threat is and how to protect themselves. They're giving it all over to government, whether it be local or federal or whatever the case may be. Perfect examples are the Microsoft, North Korea, just over and over, he's giving these examples of obvious threats, although they may be given to by people that are outside of
David,
all the other opinions.
Thanks for the call. I'll also point out on one of our callers writes in and says, one of the reasons Cassandras are not heeded is because there are too many false alarms. Think about hurricanes. It happens there often. So, Dick, is this part of the problem? People tune it out because they don't want to focus? They think there are too many false alarms?
There are too many false alarms. And what we're trying to do with the book is come up with criteria where we can judge who to listen to and who not to. We think that there are people who have an ability to see around the corner in their field of expertise. I'm not talking about people who wake up in the middle of the night with a dream or something. These are people who are experts who have data that proves to their satisfaction that something is going to happen. And they all, we interviewed 14 of these people, and they all use the same kind of phrases. They say, I don't want this to be true. Here's my data. Show me what's wrong with my data. And people don't do that. They don't argue on the basis of facts. They say, oh, well, we're busy. This doesn't fit into our agenda. We came into office as governor or mayor or president of the United States with an agenda, and this isn't part of it. So if you listen to the Cassandra, you have to change your agenda. You have to change perhaps the way you do business. You have to find money to take away from something else to put into preventing the disaster. Nobody wants that person walking into their office and saying, stop what you're doing. You have to pay attention to my issue.
Mike is on the line from Clinton, Tennessee. Hi, Mike. What's your comment?
Hi, Jessica. I don't understand how we have so much propaganda and coming from, like, let's take climate change. The fossil fuel industry has deliberately put an effort, a financial, major financial effort into getting people not to believe it's true. They have said one of their lies is, oh, it's happening, but it's not human cause. And the other thing is, oh, it's just natural climate change.
And what's your question?
But they have made it. What do you do to stop that kind of stuff? What do you do to stop these major, absolutely filthy rich groups from skewing things the wrong way and then these disasters happening?
What do you do, Dick, when you have a messaging campaign that's well-financed, well-funded, trying to silence the warnings?
Well, in many, many cases we found, in the 14 cases we looked at, there were vested interests that didn't want to listen because they would be inconvenienced or they would be hurt economically or they would be hurt politically. This is why we call in the book warnings for a process, either in the government or outside the government, of experts who listen for Cassandras and try to make a judgment whether or not they're right, and then tell everybody, based on this set of facts, we think this person could be right, and we think you ought to pay more attention.
Now, you describe this National Warning Office, and in my mind, I imagine something like NOAA, the National Weather Association, where we just trust.
No.
Go ahead.
I think this is four or five people in the White House. I don't think this is a big bureaucracy. I think they're people who can task out the existing bureaucracy to do studies and to do analysis. But I don't think we need a huge National Warning Office. We used to have a National Warning Office for national security purposes. There was actually a national intelligence officer for warning. And we talk about him as one of our Cassandras in the book. His name was Charlie Allen. And he accurately predicted that Iraq would invade and occupy Kuwait. CIA disagreed with him. The State Department disagreed with him. But he nailed it because he had a process for looking for this kind of information.
But why is he gone now? Or why is that role no longer in existence?
Well, you know, in the U.S. intelligence community, there seems to be a tendency every 5 years to reorganize all the deck chairs. And unfortunately, in that reorganization, a very valuable function, the National Intelligence Officer for Warning, was abolished.
So I guess what I'm trying to get at a bit is, isn't the bureaucracy organized in such a way that it's designed to snuff out these kinds of comments, to silence them, that they don't want to have that kind of voice inside the system? Could it be more practical to put it outside the system, warning the public?
Yeah, very, very often. The agencies that have the job of managing a set of issues don't. And they don't want to hear about it, and they don't want to argue for change. So, yes, it could be that having a warning function outside, perhaps a not-for-profit organization, might be the way to go. What we're asking for on our website, warningsbook.net, is for people who now think they've found a Cassandra. In whatever field, if you think you've seen someone who is predicting a disaster, they're an expert in their field, they are data-driven, but they're being ignored, tell us and we will try to get them publicity and we will try to analyze their warning.
Peter is calling from Lyman, Maine. Hi, Peter. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica. Thanks for taking my call. Listening to the current trend of the discussion, I immediately remember this book, Merchandising Doubt, which also is a documentary now, I believe, where the big business and any lobbyist group has so much vested interest in preserving that margin of doubt that exists with, say, like global warming or, in the past, smoking and lung cancer and things like that, that is what our bureaucracy, our government bureaucracy, responds to. And so the government then has a vested interest in preserving these margins of doubt on controversial and threatening issues. So how in the world would you ever have a government agency that would issue a early warning system under this type of circumstance?
Dick, do you have a thought on that?
Well, I think that's a very real concern. There are clearly people who are experts who appear to be bribed, who appear to be bought off to make arguments for vested interests. And so you hope that the government can have experts who are not influenced by that. I worked in the government for 30 years, and I know it's filled with good people who want to do good for the country and who are experts in their field. It's just a matter of finding them and letting them speak.
Jane is calling in from Sarasota, Florida, with a comment. Hi, Jane. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica. I was going to comment on your question as to you think we're safer with the Trump administration, and I do not think we are safer. If there seems to be plenty of information out there that the Russians did hack the 2016 election, and he keeps denying that he has no ties to Russia, and it's obvious to so many people who are reading and keeping up with things that he does have ties to Russia. So I hope this investigation brings to light what other people seem to already know.
Thank you for the call, Jane. Dick, I want to go back to something at the beginning of your book. You open with an example of Russia hacking Ukraine's election grid. So we're not the first to have been hacked by them, but this is, electric grid. How devastating would such a hack on the U.S. electric grid be, and is that even feasible?
Well, the experts disagree about how significant it could be. The Cassandra that we profile in the book, a guy named Joe Weiss, says that you could take out one of the three U.S. power grids by hacking into the right part of the grid and causing a cascading failure. He was ignored for a long time. And then when we saw the Russians get into the Ukrainian power grid, hack their way into the control system, and literally turn it off, now people are listening to Joe Weiss.
Someone's written in online asking, what are thoughts or preparations regarding an EMP, I think that's an electromagnetic pulse nuclear attack, that would disable wide swaths of the electric grid?
Well, we thought very seriously about writing a chapter in the book on this threat. But you can only write so many chapters in a book, and then it becomes a book that you can't even pick up. It's so big. So we have 14 people that we profile, 14 different issues from economics to engineering. We briefly talk about this possible threat from electromagnetic pulse in the summary at the end of the book. It is certainly something that experts are warning about. I don't know whether they're right, but they probably deserve to be heard.
It is certainly a favorite topic in Hollywood, where it's the scenario of most of their disaster films being written right now.
Yeah, and that's a problem with all of these. You know, that Hollywood, when it picks up one of these things, discredits the real world in a way. You don't think about asteroids. You don't think about all these other things because you saw the movie. Hmm. You don't think about artificial intelligence taking over because you saw Terminator. And that makes you think it's silly, makes you think it's fiction. Hmm.
Chris is calling in from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. What's your comment?
Hi, Jessica. Doesn't a Cassandra's success also discredit them by predicting and heading off the problem? They essentially make the prediction not true anymore?
Excellent question. Go ahead.
That's certainly been the case in the past. You know, Y2K comes to mind. There were a handful of people that said around the millennium rollover that if we didn't change all the software in our computers, we'd have massive computer failure. They were heard, and an awful lot of money was spent, and a huge government effort was conducted in the United States and around the world, and then it didn't happen. So people now look back and say, oh, well, that was some sort of hokum by the computer industry to get people to spend money on new software. Actually, it wasn't. There would have been a major problem. But it's very hard to convince people of that now because we prevented that problem.
There are many other topics you cover in this book, pandemic, disease, gene editing. It is a fascinating read. I wish we could get through them all, but I want to end on a positive note. Is there any cause for optimism you see on the horizon?
Yes, there is. If we can figure out how to spot these Cassandras, we can stop catastrophes.
Fantastic. Richard Clark, thank you so much for being with us. Former National Counterterrorism Coordinator on the White House National Security Council, I'm grateful for your time.
Thank you.
His book is Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Stop Catastrophes, and it is a fascinating read. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter or find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.